This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Robert Wolf writes, "Only after living in northeastern Iowa for 1 year could I begin to understand how rootedness in place provided the nurturing for community. The rootedness of small towns and rural populations in the last century was what gave many American communities their distinct qualities. When the present crop of farmers passes away, with them will go their way of life and their simplicity, directness, and honesty." Wolf, a writer and publisher from Decorah, has run writing workshops with farm families, small town residents, and others living in the so-called Driftless area for 18 years. The result is the second edition of his book, Heartland Portraits, Stories from the Rural Midwest. This hour, we'll talk to Wolf live and two of his contributors, John Presteman of Waukon and Mary Klauke of Rural Dubuque. First, news from Iowa Public Radio and NPR. And welcome to Talk of Iowa for this Monday. I'm Dennis Reese. Robert Wolf writes, If stories were written and developed in writing workshops over 18 years by people without literary ambition living in the Driftless region, an area of approximately 160,000 square miles. The Driftless region is marked by a topography of hills and winding valleys and spreads across southeast Minnesota, southwest Wisconsin, northeast Iowa, and a small area of northwest Illinois. It is a rural area with only three cities with populations over 50,000, Rochester, Minnesota, La Crosse, Wisconsin, and Dubuque, Iowa. Based on rural writing workshops, Robert Wolf, out of Decorah, Iowa, has come out with a second edition of a very fine book called Heartland Portraits, Stories from the Rural Midwest. He joins us from our studio, our Iowa Public Radio studio in Cedar Falls. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Dennis.
Well, I'm glad you made it to Cedar Falls from Decorah on this very nice Monday morning. You know, I didn't know what the Driftless area was until I read the book, and I thought immediately, well, it's Driftless is a geological term, obviously. Could you explain that?
Yes. Glaciers, two lobes of a glacier passed around this area that I'm speaking of, and therefore it did not leave drift, the rocks and the scree and the junk that usually is left behind when the glaciers recede. So having missed this area, this region, the region is therefore driftless.
And this is, again, northeast Iowa, about, four counties in northeast Iowa?
Actually, more than that. It extends probably from Bellevue, Iowa, north. It's very a very narrow sliver down by Bellevue. It widens out heading to the west, and certainly there's probably the four counties up in the northeast section, plus a few more down south, and just fractions of those. And I imagine, I really don't know, but I imagine it's the whole area, maybe about three quarters the size of Massachusetts, something like that.
Well, at any rate, you know, Robert, the fact is you love the area. It's as you mentioned, the land is not especially rich for farming, not compared to north central Iowa, central Iowa, where there's a lot more black soil. But it's hilly and beautiful, and this is the area that you truly love, and you know this area so well. You know the towns, you know the people. What is it that why have you chosen to spend your life in this particular area?
Partly because of the beauty of it, and partly because of the people, or very much so because of the people there. As I wrote somewhere else, there's a great dignity to the farming population, and it's an area that obviously is not overrun by traffic or manufacture. I mean, it's a rural area. I prefer living in rural America as opposed to urban America, where I have lived for years, both in New York City and Chicago. So when my wife and I, when she first took me out to northeast Iowa, she wanted to prove to me that not all Iowa was flat.
That's right.
Yeah. And so we came up, we went from Chicago to down to Dubuque, and then took the river road north, and it begins ascending along a ridge by Rickardsville. You're on a ridge, and both sides of that ridge slope away into these two large, vast, beautiful valleys with these small farmsteads. And it's not as immense as New Mexico, but it kind of reminded me of a bit in terms of the space and the beauty of it. And I'd lived in New Mexico for many years. And I said to my wife, I can live here. And that was the beginning of a love affair.
Robert Wolf is with me from our studio in Cedar Falls. You've operated the Free River Press out of Decorah now for, 20 years, Robert, something like that. And you had a first edition of this book that came out in the mid-90s, and correct me if I'm wrong, of Heartland Portraits. And you've done this major update of the book based on writing workshops that you organized, and these workshops were held in small towns and in farmhouses, and it all started with good friends of yours, Bill and Esther Welsh. Could you tell the story?
Right. When we moved up, we made the decision to move from Nashville up to Iowa. I knew I wanted to I'd been working with the homeless in Nashville, and knew that I wanted to get farm voices heard. I wanted people in urban America to know what was happening in to rural America, to the farm economy, because that was going to affect the food supply. I wanted people to know what was going to happen to the quality of their food and possible scarcity, which turned out not to be true. But so I wanted to organize a writing workshop among the farmers in our area, and a friend of mine, Bruce Carlson, who is a dentist in Lansing, said, you got to get a hold of Bill and S.E. Welsh. Bill Welsh was one of the first organic farmers in our area. And when I heard that, read in the paper that Bill was going to have a farm tour, I went and met another neighbor of ours, Bob Leppert. And as we walked around the farm, I explained to Bob that I wanted to do a workshop. I wanted to give farmers a voice, and he was intrigued by it. And after that tour, we sat around with the Welshes in their garage, and I talked to them about the project. And Bill's son Greg was intrigued with it. He thought it should be done. He convinced his father and mother to do it. And then the four of us sat around a few nights later and began drawing up a list of possible contributors. We had about four or five farm families who were the core of the project. Others would come and go. And we began on Monday nights after fall harvest and went until spring. We met every Monday night starting at 7 o'clock, wrote until about 10 o'clock at night. And then we'd have some coffee and some lunch, what they called lunch. And this continued for a little over 2 years. After that first winter, we did a small book called Voices from the Land. I did an initial printing of 500 copies of that, and we didn't have any money. The press didn't have any money. I couldn't afford to have the printer collate the pages, so we got them in stacks, pages 1 and 3, 4, whatever, around the kitchen table, and all the writers, all the contributors to the book, we came around and we collated the book that way. And then I brought it to the printer and had it done that way. And Minnesota Public Radio did a story on it that went to Morning Edition, and that sold out very promptly. The phone rang off the hook for 3 days, and I very promptly did another second edition of 1,000. That sold out. The AP did a story that went in almost every major daily in the country except the Wall Street Journal, so we did a third printing. And there were two other farm books that came out after that. They all did well, like Voices from the Land. And I put those together along with some stories from small towns that had hired me to do books. And that was the first edition of Heartland Portrait, but that was confined strictly to Northeast Iowa. And, of course, this edition has stories from Minnesota and Wisconsin, as well as Iowa, and has a considerably large selection of stories from small towns.
talking about the book, Heartland Portraits, Stories from the Rural Midwest, published by Free River Press, now in a second edition after 18 years. Robert Wolf, the editor. Robert, we've heard of the famed Iowa Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. These writing workshops or writing classes are not quite the same thing. I mean, you don't walk in as a professor trying to teach these small-town people how to write, these rural folks who live in this the so-called driftless area. You're probably more of a facilitator? How do you describe yourself?
Certainly a facilitator. I had taught composition for many years at Chicago colleges. And I knew that if, and in those classes, I found that if I got the students to tell their stories before they wrote them, that would really facilitate the whole writing process. So that's what we do in each workshop. I begin by reading. We read stories that I have published so that they know that you don't have to have special training to write effectively. We talk about what made the stories effective. Maybe it's imagery, maybe it's dialogue, whatever. And then everyone tells their story. And people ask them questions about their story to get them to flesh it out. Maybe they want more imagery. Maybe they want dialogue and so forth. And after everyone has done that, then we write. And we write nonstop for about an hour, hour and a half. I tell them, write as closely as you can to the way you told it. For two reasons. One, it preserves their voice, and two, it takes the mystery out of writing. And I tell them not to worry about spelling or punctuation or grammar, none of that, because that can all be dealt with later.
Now, this is all nonfiction, we should clarify.
Right, right.
These are stories about actual lives lived and fascinating stories. We want to ask you about Clara Lippman, as we get the first essay in the book, as maybe the perfect example of one of these essays. I guess we have time to at least start with that before we get to the break, Robert. This is a woman who lived into her late 80s. Her essay is called Simple Lives, but, you know, it's absolutely amazing. The story she tells about this life, her life on the farm, raising her sons and daughters, you know, the thing that occurred to me was how, despite the difficulties and the terrible winters in the Waukon area, she just loved her life, didn't she?
Absolutely. She was a wonderful, sweet lady. And yeah, she has stories about the family hitching up the horses to a sleigh and heading 10 miles into Lansing during the winter.
And I'm thinking, you know, the winters in far northeast Iowa are not pleasant.
No, far from it.
Well, we'll talk more about Clara Lippman and some of the other essays. And two of the contributors are on the line with us also. And we'll be talking to them in just about a minute as Talk of Iowa continues. Heartland Portraits, Stories, Rural Midwest. Back in a minute. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese with Robert Wolf of the Free River Press and Decorah, new edition of a fabulous book called Heartland Portrait Stories from the Rural Midwest, updated in the second edition after, 18 years, Robert?
I think the first one came out in 97, something like that.
So, oh, okay, so not
so
quite that.
11 years, something like that. 12.
12 years. And Robert's at our studio in Cedar Falls. I think maybe right now it would be good to talk to two of our other contributors before the hour gets away. Time goes so fast. But John Presteman, and I hope I have Mary's last name correct, Klauke. Am I saying that right, Robert?
Yes.
John Presteman and Mary Klauke are on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mary, I hope you're there too.
Good morning. I am, and I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, let's start with John Presteman. John, you grew up on the family farm near Waukon, graduate from Drake University with majors in history and philosophy, but you decided in 1960 to forget the history and philosophy, and not so much to forget it, but at least to forget it as a career and take over the farm operation. That had to be a pretty big decision, wasn't it?
Well, it was, and it came kind of as a surprise to my parents and my wife at the time, but I got thinking I was going into law, and then I decided it really wasn't that exciting. And what I really enjoyed was my summers on the farm. And so I said, why not? Dad's health was failing, and I thought, why not just give that a shot and take over the family farm and do what I really love? So we did.
And you were farming for a long time, retiring, what, in 2008?
Well, I retired from farming in 1997, and then I went into real estate sales for a few years, and then I retired finally in 2008.
Well, you have an essay in the book called Farming or Agribusiness, and I thought there's two audio recordings of you and Mary reading just brief excerpts from the essay. So I thought if it's okay with you, I would play one of these short excerpts. So are you ready? So this is a John Prestman reading from his chapter called Farming or Agribusiness.
Farming or Agribusiness. This is John Prestman. Sometime in the 1980s, farming stopped being fun, at least for us. Farming became an intense effort in managing resources and inputs, with the hope of extracting a small profit in the end. In short, it became much less a way of life and much more just a business. Some liked that new emphasis. I did not. The farming I loved in my younger years gradually died, like a victim of some insidious cancer. Almost all of us farmers succumbed to the siren song, "Big is efficient, this way to prosperity." Reluctance to adopt the newest technologies meant you were old-fashioned and hopelessly out of step. This was a case of peer pressure as well as economic pressure. Competition replaced cooperation. Independence superseded dependence. We forgot to visit our neighbors. We just didn't have time. We were determined to be better than they were, to come out on top, and to prove that we didn't really need each other, or so it seemed. Those of us who lived through this immense and continuing transformation in agriculture of the second half of the 20th century were carried along by forces we could not control. Many of us, especially after 1980, felt frustrated that we were on a treadmill forcing us to run faster and faster just to stay in place. To some extent, we were in denial, refusing to accept the reality of what was happening. We could not comprehend the rapidly accelerating rate of change that was being forced upon us. In retrospect, it was amazing how fast things changed. It was a good life on the farm. It was a great place to raise a family, and we were provided a decent living. But what we enjoyed and experienced is history. I fear that it will not be available in large measure to many in succeeding generations. We are optimistic, however, that a small number of aspiring young farmers will yet succeed on smaller farms in the coming years. They will be smart, ambitious, and willing to make sacrifices, and will succeed by finding niches or raising organic crops and livestock. And in most cases, a good portion of income will come from off-farm jobs. I believe that in the future we will see the vast majority of agricultural production coming from mega farms, and to a large extent that is the case even today. What a shame that we are regressing to a system of landed aristocracy, corporate control, and a labor force that is no longer truly independent.
John Prestman reading from his essay in Heartland Portrait, Stories from the Rural Midwest, edited by Robert Wolf. John, you got hit hard by the farm crisis in the 80s, as I was reading your essay. But you certainly weren't the only one, and it was just it was a terrible time, and debt just seemed to pile up. That did happen to you, is that right?
Yeah, it was a case of being almost out of debt at one point, and then deciding to do some investing and changing when the kids left and went to college. And it proved to be a poor time to do that, and from then on it seemed like it was just kind of a treadmill, as I said, to stay in place. We always had a significant net worth, but we weren't making any progress, and I could see that it just wasn't going to be a good future if I stayed on the farm, even though we ended up with significant monies after we sold everything. We weren't broke or anything like that, but it just wasn't fun to be working that hard and not to be making progress.
And what was happening here was that you were sort of encouraged to add on, to buy new machinery, to put up new buildings, because you were sort of being handed money by bankers to do all this expansion, and then all of a sudden it crashed. Something like what happened in 2008, but on a different scale. But many, many farmers were affected by bankers taking the loans back, and it was really a horrible situation. How did this? Could you give us just a little bit of a history on how this happened and why it happened?
Well, I think the transformation happened at the time when interest rates got up to. I remember I was paying over 20% on short-term loans at the bank, and even my mortgage on the farm was up in the double digits quite a ways. I can't remember exactly, and there just isn't that much profit in agriculture as far as I could see. So from that point on, I was mainly paying the interest, working hard to stay in place, as I said, and I kept good help. I had a wonderful hired man, and I paid him quite well, and we had a really good time together, working together. But it just didn't leave me with any profit in the end. So, but one of the reasons I decided to retire at that time from farming too was because I had some physical problems with arthritis and had a shoulder that was operated on, and that didn't help make it any fun either.
Robert Wolf, did you want to add anything about the farm crisis in the 80s? Because you have a big section of the book specifically about that.
Yeah, a farmer might go in, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but a farmer might go into the bank to make get a loan for a relatively small improvement, and the banker would say, well, why not take out maybe 10 times as much, $200,000 loan to do even something more significant. And that was one way the farmers fell into that. I mean, the bankers themselves were deceived as to what was going to happen. I mean, there was going to be just continual profits for everyone. So there were a lot of bank failures as well. It just wasn't solely the bankers being evil guys. They were duped by other forces. There was a Committee on Economic Development that meets, I don't know, once every few years, and sometime back in the 60s, and this committee is comprised of a lot of corporate heads, it was decided sometime back in the 60s that they needed to cut down on the number of farmers since mechanization was going full tilt and that we didn't need so many farmers. So there were various ideas proposed as to how to eliminate the number of farmers so that they could fill needed factory work, factory positions in the cities. And so this was one of the motivating forces. And let's not forget that Earl Butz, who was Eisenhower's Secretary of Agriculture, said, get big or get out. So there was this constant encouragement to the constantly increase size and take on debt.
We need to take a break. John Prestaman, Robert Wolf, hold on. Also, Mary Klocke, we'll get to you right after the break, the Environment Report coming up, about a five-minute break. We are live this hour, so we'd like to welcome your calls and questions. 866-780-9100. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.edu. Heartland Portrait, stories from the rural Midwest. We'll continue our conversation in 5 minutes as Talk of Iowa continues here on Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese. Today, discussing the second edition of a very fine book called Heartland Portrait, Stories from the Rural Midwest, published by the Free River Press out of Decorah, Iowa. Robert Wolf is the publisher. Also on the program, John Prestaman and Mary Klocke, two of the many contributors to this anthology, based on writing workshops held in many, many rural communities, mostly small towns, what's called the Driftless Region, northeast Iowa, southeast Minnesota, southwest Wisconsin, and a portion of northwest Illinois. Robert, did I get all of that correct?
Yes, you did, Dennis.
Okay. Driftless because of the glaciers and a beautiful area. Indeed, it's hilly, but maybe not the best farmland, but good enough to produce some great crops. It is good enough, isn't it? I mean, you do your yields are about up there with some areas of central Iowa, eastern Iowa.
Well, I think Mary and John should be the ones to answer that.
Okay. Let's talk to Mary Klauke. Mary, nice to talk to you. You farmed for many years around, was it Dubuque County? Or were you into?
Actually, in Alma Key County.
In Alma Key County, which is the most, the northeast most Iowa county, right?
That's right. Actually, I grew up on a farm just over the hill from the farm that we bought in 1980, which was really, after listening to John, you know, it was the worst time in the world to buy a farm.
Yeah, it sure was, wasn't it? And you've also worked for the Dubuque Archdiocese, is that right?
Right, right. I've been, actually, I still do work for Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Dubuque. And up until just a year ago, worked with the Rural Life Department, mm-hmm. Which is something that we started doing. We started working with them back in the early 90s. In 1995, I believe, we were asked to take over that department.
Now, your husband...
We worked with a lot of the farmers that went through the crisis along with us in the 80s.
Now, your husband has passed away, is that right?
That's right.
But you wrote this essay with him.
Right, we did. And, you know, I think it was kind of a genius thing that we were the ones that needed to do that because he grew up in Chicago, actually. Mm-hmm. And so we really had to start from the beginning in 1980 of, you know, how to farm and really studying and analyzing what was happening to farmers. So it was, we were asked to write a primer on vertical integration and...
All right, let me just, I want to play your audio excerpt here in just a second. You sort of described this, but before we get to that, what is vertical integration?
Well, really, it's the, it's some company owning everything from the genetics or the seed all the way through to the shelf in the grocery store, where they have control of it in some way, whether they own it or have exclusive relationships with the companies. It's integration from the ground up, from the ground to the plate, I guess you could say.
Okay. Well, let's listen to your audio excerpt from the book Heartland Portrait, Stories in Rural Midwest. This is Mary Klauke reading a portion, about a two-minute portion of her essay.
What happens to communities when corporations do the farming? Neighbors are pitted against neighbor, brothers against brother. In one situation, a woman is losing the daycare business she has established in her home because her husband's brothers, with another investor, are putting a large-scale hog confinement operation 1/4 mile from her house. All those who have invested in the operation live away from the site and do not personally bear the consequences of their action on the air, water, and land. Many times, local and state governments provide incentives in the form of tax abatements or forgivable loans if corporations will come into an area and create jobs. Rural jobs may be created with the new pork-producing corporations moving into an area, but they are extremely low-paying and offer little or no benefits. At the same time, many more farmers are going out of business because traditional markets are no longer available to them. The corporations have no need for the business in the community. They bring in their own builders and supplies, and in some cases, their own concrete plants. They supply their own processors, so there are no buying stations. The people who have worked in the buying stations are jobless, as well as the farmers who are displaced. Other local businesses lose as the money made from the production of food and fiber is leaving the community and going to the corporate investors. It seems to be a case of taking from the poor and giving to the rich. What happens to the food when corporations do the hog farming? Pork is grown in strictly controlled conditions for the profit's sake, not for good taste or healthfulness. Antibiotics used on the animals, mostly to help them grow faster, not treat illness, are creating drug-resistant germs that are ingested by people in their food. But this is just one more hidden price we pay when we purchase completely prepared food from faceless, nameless people. thereby losing a relationship to food, to other gifts of creation, and to the Creator.
Mary Klauke reading from her essay in Heartland Portrait, Stories from the Rural Midwest. It sounds, Mary, like you would agree with John Prestemann's final sentence when he says, what a shame that we are regressing to a system of landed aristocracy, corporate control, and a labor force that is no longer truly independent. Now, you've been working with the Dubuque Archdiocese, the rural life program of the Archdiocese. Can you describe just sort of, have you been counseling farmers who are having trouble making their debt payments and are losing their land? Can you give us a little idea of what you do in that capacity?
Well, as I said, I'm no longer working in that capacity anymore, but you're right. Probably more than counseling, I would say listening to them and then helping them find the networks that they needed to move on, to either get the help that they needed or to change whatever they needed to change in their life or whatever. It was more to help them see options, which was something that we could do because of the networking that we did.
How many farms have been lost in that area of Northeast Iowa? Certainly these farms keep getting bigger in the region, what's called the Driftless region.
You know, I cannot even answer that question. I'm sorry, but I don't know the numbers. But I can tell you that a lot of them have been lost. We used to be able to count dairy farms between the Minnesota border and Waukon just on Highway 76, and all of a sudden there were no dairy farms on the highway anymore. And, you know, that's just a small indication. What I do see now, though, is more people, younger people trying to do smaller kinds of farming with more direct marketing. And so that would create more jobs or more farms.
And the small towns just keep getting smaller, it seems like.
Well, that, or disappearing completely.
Oh, really? Yeah. You write about that, Robert Wolf.
Yes.
About so many of Iowa's towns, many of these towns have been losing populations for a very long time, actually since about 1900.
Right. Yeah. The Driftless region, actually, it had its peak population, I believe, in 1880, and began a slow decline after that, and still going on. I'd like to know, We do get newcomers. We get folks from the cities, Chicago, I suppose, the Twin Cities. But on the whole, there's been a continual decline. I think it's slowing down, but it's a continual decline of population, and it's sad and kind of depressing to see the empty storefronts in the small towns. You wonder when it's going to stop. It has a debilitating effect, just generally. It's not something that's encouraging. We wish that we could find a way to reverse things, to revitalize the economy, and to be more self-reliant, and not to rely on outside corporations and companies to bring us work. But wish we could find ways to develop our own capital and industry.
Well, one way you talk about to revitalize is the whole concept of community-supported agriculture and organic farms. And so that one large section of the book is very, very hopeful, because there's truly been a lot of people who have decided to pursue this line of organic farming, farmers markets, community-supported agriculture, essays in the book with farmers who have gone this route and have been very successful, and not just successful, but, extremely happy and content with this line of work. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think of Linda Hawley, who was, she manages a farm up in Minnesota now, but she was with Harmony Valley Farm over in Wisconsin. Yeah, there are a number of contributors to that section of the book who lead really very productive and very gratifying, satisfied lives.
She started, she was divorced, moved to the Madison area, great essay, and started on her own, I guess it was her parents' land, but selling raspberries and wonderful vegetables at the famous Madison Capitol Square Farmers Market,
yeah.
Moved on to marry another organic farm. Now they have their own land, doing very well.
Yeah, yeah. No, her story is very interesting, and it's a great story. And the one that follows that, called "The Farmer's Daughter," written by Lynn Chumper up in Wisconsin, follows almost similar lines. It was interesting how those two women grew up on farms, migrated to the cities, but then were called back to the land and found their way into organic farming. Both of them, and doing very well.
866-780-9100 if you have questions, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mary is calling from Iowa City. Good morning. Mary, whoops, let me press the button. That would help. Hello, Mary.
Good morning. I hear your guest talking about Earl Butts and how he socialized farming, because he wanted big farms. So that was the government interfering with the farmers. And so we talk about socialism now. We don't know what we're talking about. And another thing, tourism. Obama has this thing. I was supposed to have this committee to encourage tourism. Iowa is a very interesting state to the Europeans. So we just got to push ourselves as a place to stay.
Mary, thank you for the comment. Appreciate it. Robert, do you have anything you want to add?
Well, Earl Butts wasn't advocating socialism because ownership was still in private hands. It wasn't the land wasn't going into government hands, and the farming wasn't being done by the government. But it was certainly government intervention, but not direct intervention. It was indirect.
Right. You have Robert. You have your own commentaries in the book. I found it really interesting, the section on rivers, because I hadn't really thought so much about rivers. But you talk about what's happened to the Mississippi and how it's been so modified, especially north of St. Louis. But I didn't realize that south of St. Louis, it's not quite as bad. Could you explain that?
Yeah, south of St. Louis, they don't have the dams, the locks and dams, and so the river's still wild. There was a wonderful essay written by a friend of mine, in Dyersburg, Tennessee. He's a marine biologist, he takes annual trips with students out on the Mississippi. And it's his essay is "My Mississippi Mistress." He says, I like her untamed. He says, above St. Louis, he says, it's not a river, it's just nine pools. And you have to go below the Mississippi to get that feeling for what the river once was. And we've probably made a mistake, but in one sense, I mean, from the point of view of the grain buyers, it's not a mistake to put in the locks and dams. But the idea back in the old days was, how are we going to contain this river? And one way was to put in locks and dams. The other was to put in outlets so that the water could be diverted. And maybe that was the correct solution. Now we're going to rebuild all these locks and dams to accommodate larger toes. They're going to have just, I think, almost extended by another 200 feet just for the convenience mm-hmm. of some of these corporations like Cargill.
Well, I was absolutely amazed by the amount of fishing that had occurred in north of St. Louis in the Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota area along the Mississippi. You write, in 1963, Lansing, that's referring to Lansing, Iowa, of course, Lansing fishermen harvested 3 to 4 million pounds of fish. Otherwise, it ran 3 to 5 million pounds a year. It was like farming. It took a lot of families to produce the volume early on, so there were 40, 50, 60 families at one time that earned their living clamming, fishing, trapping, and a combination of those. Their livelihood came from the river. As more people fished, the catch got smaller. Absolutely amazing that much fishing was happening. It's certainly not the case anymore, is it?
No, the fishermen are by and large gone. And, yeah, it's the same story repeated on the river that we know about on the land. Yeah, it's a tragedy. And the Mississippi gets so much industrial runoff that it's just not safe to eat that fish more than probably you know, maybe once a week, something like that.
Yeah. And if you'll let me turn to another one of your commentaries, Robert, I hope this is okay, that I wanted to also, you had a commentary on villages and towns, and let me read part of this. It's very brief. As long as regions retain their small but important industries, they remained relatively self-sufficient until the advent of the Sears Roebuck Catalog. A 1908 editorial in the Preston, Minnesota newspaper complained bitterly about the amount of money that the catalog was drawing from southeast Minnesota and urged locals to buy locally. I was so amused by this. And you say it's an editorial that could be written today.
Yep.
In any of several thousand small towns, and I'm thinking of Walmart.
Oh, yes. Gosh. Yeah. Yeah. Same story.
So the Sears Roebuck catalog was maybe started all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a centralization of selling, buying and selling. Geez. Sears even sold, you probably know, they sold houses. You could order order a house from the catalog, and they'd ship it out to you by train, and you assemble it.
Did this really have that much of a economic impact, the Sears Roebuck catalog back at the turn of the last century? Or was this,
No, I assume it did. I think it probably,
really?
Yeah. And so, to reiterate what I said earlier, I mean, we need to find ways to increase manufacture in our areas. I mean, if we're going to escape the trauma of a national depression, which I assume we're in right now, and I think it's going to get worse, rural America has to figure out how it's going to get more self-reliant. We can't. Where's the money going to come from to buy these outside goods? Why can't we find ways to create capital within our regions and to create our own industries so that we're not sending money out of the region the way we do with the farms? A lot of these vertically integrated industries that Mary wrote about and talks about, the money that comes from the sale of their products goes out of rural America. It doesn't stay here. We need to find ways to keep money in rural America.
Let's go to another caller. Craig is calling from Cedar Rapids. Good morning, Craig. And Craig is in Cedar Rapids. Craig, good morning.
Hi. I just am trying to figure out how we can get the government aware of what they're doing to this country. They just seem to be oblivious to it because there's so much more tax revenue that they can gain from corporations than small business, but they're just forming monopolies all over this country. And how can we put a stop to all this?
Well, I don't. Do you have a comment on that, Robert?
Yeah. If the antitrust laws were actually enforced, they're on the books, but they're not enforced. If they were enforced, then I don't think we wouldn't be in the depth of trouble that we are in.
All right, Craig, thanks for the call. We're just about out of time, and I want to just sort of go to the three of you to see if there's anything to be hopeful about. We mentioned organic farming, community-supported agriculture, just a lot of farmers starting these small organic farms. Will this be enough to save these rural areas in the Driftless region? I want to start with John Prestaman. Are you optimistic?
Well, I think it's going to be really hard to turn this ship around. It's gone so long now. Berglund, Secretary Berglund, back in the 80s, I think it was, had a study that showed the structure of agriculture needed to be changed, and it was clearly we were going in the wrong direction, but nothing happened, I think the organic part is some of it. I think the government has to be recognition, and maybe this has to come from the people, from the consumer originally, to get pressure on the government to give them this recognition that there has to be some change in government policies and the way subsidies are distributed and so on, if we're going to have subsidies to encourage conservation and small farming and that sort of thing.
If we could turn the clock back to 1960 when you finished your degree from Drake, would you as a young man choose farming again?
No, I would not. I have some close relatives that are still farming, but they're inorganic, and And I'm hopeful for them. I hope that works, and it has been so far.
But, it's been working so far, you said.
Yes, it is.
That's good. Mary Klauke, are you optimistic at all about maybe organic farming, other small businesses turning some of this region around economically?
Well, I'm trying very hard to be optimistic. My daughter and son-in-law are just at the point of wanting to take over our farm and they will have to build a business completely of their own. Because it has to be completely changed. I think that my hope is in the consumer because people are becoming more interested in the food they eat. And it just kind of blows my mind that we're spending so much time talking about health care and about poverty. And I really believe that both of those critical problems could be solved by the way we grow and eat our food.
Okay, thank you, Mary Klauke. And finally, Robert Wolf, publisher. Would you go into farming today if you had to start all over again?
Absolutely not.
Okay. But we have to be somewhat optimistic. I mean, it sounds like from what Mary and John said, there's some sons and daughters and friends are doing pretty well in the small-scale agriculture.
Sure. But I said no because I've always been a writer, and that's my calling. But, yeah, no, I mean, there can be a turnaround. There may be a big turnaround, not just in agriculture, but in other aspects of the economy here. It all depends on people's will and their desire to really cooperate and work together.
Are you going to continue with these writing workshops in these rural areas, small town?
I'm focusing on the Southwest right now, and when I do a comparable anthology, I move to the Mississippi Delta to continue my work there, which I began about 20 years ago.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. It's a great book. Robert Wolf, thank you, and thanks to John Prestman and Mary Klauke. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you.
The book is Heartland Portrait, Stories from the Rural Midwest, edited by Robert Wolf. Published by the Free River Press out of Decorah, Iowa. I'd like to thank Robert Wolf, John Prestman, and Mary Klauke for taking part in the conversation. And help today from Jeff Schmidt. That's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio News.